I tell our fellows in training here all the time, you know, there's really only two things that you can do wrong when managing a sarcoid patient. One is to miss dangerous organ involvement, and then one is to treat a patient for no good reason.
My name is Jonathan Alisea, and welcome back to the Rare Disease Report. Sarcoidosis, a systemic inflammatory condition, is marked by the presentation of granulomas, or lumps, across various organs of the body, be it the lungs, the heart, or on the skin, for example. Some patients may require treatment, while most may not. And so, clinicians and specialists must judge the proper path forward for each affected individual they see. The big question mark surrounding this condition, however, is the cause. Where does it originate? What triggers it? There's still much work to be done in this domain. For this episode of the Rare Disease Report, Dr. Ennis James joined me in honor of April Sarcoidosis Awareness Month. Dr. James is a pulmonologist and the program director of the Susan Pearlstein Sarcoidosis Center of Excellence at the Medical University of South Carolina. He is also affiliated with the Foundation for Sarcoidosis Research as a member of their Scientific Advisory Board and Steering Committee of the Foundation's Clinical Studies Network. Currently, his primary focus is on improving and optimizing care for sarcoidosis patients through clinical practice and research. In our conversation, we spoke about the challenges for sarcoidosis patients, the decisions healthcare providers must make in their care for them, as well as directions for future research. He gave some insight into the historical context of the disease. He also highlighted important care practices, including the reasons a clinician may choose not to offer treatments to patients affected by sarcoidosis. We covered a lot of ground, but remained committed to one goal, bringing you the most up-to-date and accurate rare disease report. Enjoy. Thank you so much, Dr. James, for joining me today on the Rare Disease Report. I'm happy to have you here.
Thanks for having me. Great to be here.
So today we're going to talk about sarcoidosis. Before we get into that, can you tell me a bit about yourself, the work you do, and how you got into this clinical domain?
Definitely. I am a pulmonologist by training. I'm currently a faculty member at the Medical University of South Carolina, where I'm the program director for the Susan Pearlstein Sarcoidosis Center of Excellence. I've been in that role for the last 5 years, and I guess I would say I got into sarcoidosis really while I was in training in Virginia, at Virginia Commonwealth University in Richmond. And as a pulmonary fellow who would see a lot of sarcoidosis patients in clinic, and, you know, as a trainee, I would go to my attendings who, you know, are supposed to be all knowing and be able to tell me what to do. But when it came to sarcoid patients, oftentimes the answer was, well, we don't really know the right thing to do. And so it seemed like an area that, you know, a lot of improvements could be made and there was a lot to learn. And I was fortunate enough to get to do it in practice after I graduated.
That's awesome. And to get right into it, can you tell me a bit about sarcoidosis? What is it and how is it discovered? So what's the historical context, if you want to add that in as well?
Yeah. So I'll start with the historical context. So it was really first described as a skin condition all the way back in like 1869, I think it was, by a guy named Hutchinson. And there was a patient named, her last name was Mortimer, I think, and he called it Mortimer's Malady. So basically it was, the easiest way to recognize it for a lot of patients is the skin condition, which about 20% of patients can have. But over the years, you know, up into the early 1900s, they then found out that, oh, it also causes enlarged lymph nodes. Oh, it also causes lung disease. In the 40s, I think it was finally described as being a potentially affecting the heart. And that kind of brings us up to where we are now, where we know it's an immune system disease. It's not technically an autoimmune disease. I tell patients it's a systemic inflammatory disease. We don't know what causes it. The theory is that you get exposed to something in the environment that triggers an abnormal response from the immune system. And the end result is that the immune system is just kind of an overdrive. And as a result of that, you get a lot of what we call granulomatous inflammation throughout the body that can really affect any organ system. You know, 90% of patients will have lung involvement, which is why you'll commonly see pulmonologists as being the ones who manage sarcoidosis. But, you know, we see a lot of patients with skin involvement, eye involvement, heart involvement, brain involvement. It can really do anything. And so that's really historically why it's been a very difficult disease to manage, because it can present in so many different ways.
So is there a type of population that it typically affects, or are there certain people that are more prone to getting or having sarcoidosis?
Yeah, so, you know, it can really affect anybody. Black patients are more likely to get sarcoidosis, although if you look at the total number of patients in the United States who have sarcoidosis, just based on our population, there's overall more white patients with sarcoidosis. But we certainly know that Black Americans tend to have more severe disease. They're more likely to be treated and, you know, tend to require treatment for longer periods of time.
So my dad actually has sarcoidosis, and it's, I believe, a mild case in that it doesn't typically affect his quality of life too much. But can you just speak to what's the patient experience with it, especially in terms of patients that you may see?
Extremely variable. You know, some patients will get diagnosed as an incidental finding. Let's say you get in a car accident and you go to the emergency room and they do a CT scan and they see these enlarged lymph nodes and ultimately find out it's sarcoidosis. And those patients may never have symptoms. So it ranges all the way from that to, you know, having multiple organ systems involved, you know, with potentially causing symptoms such as shortness of breath, pain, fatigue is a very common symptom. Patients who have heart involvement, for example, can have heart failure symptoms as a result. I would say overall, the quality of life in sarcoid patients really depends in part on how their disease is managed. One of the tricky parts about sarcoidosis is that while certainly the disease can affect your quality of life, a lot of the medications we use can also affect quality of life as well. And so I've seen plenty of patients who, yes, they had some symptoms, but when we started them on treatment, some of the treatment actually made them feel worse. And there's this sort of general guideline now that we use to determine when patients need treatment. And it's called Wells's Law. And basically he said that there's two reasons to treat a sarcoid patient. One is if they have, as we refer to, dangerous organ involvement. So that's sarcoidosis in your heart, brain, kidneys, eyes, and causing high calcium levels. So that's one reason. The other reason would be to improve somebody's quality of life. And I tell patients every day, they are a much better determinant of their quality of life than I am. And so if we start a medicine and it's not improving their quality of life because of side effects, then certainly treatment options are negotiable in that situation.
So it's actually interesting, before, when you mentioned sarcoidosis can be diagnosed incidentally, that they're looking for something else. That's actually how it was for my dad, that they were doing blood work and other types of screening. They were looking at, I don't even know the full story, but they incidentally diagnosed it. Is that the majority of cases? How is sarcoidosis typically screened and diagnosed? Like, what does that typically look like for that?
Yeah. So most patients that are diagnosed with sarcoidosis do have some type of symptom. Probably the most common way it presents is with some sort of respiratory symptom, but it can present with, you know, fevers and weight loss, for example, or just skin lesions on the face. The diagnosis is made when somebody has a, as we say, a compatible clinical presentation, meaning they have symptoms and imaging findings consistent with sarcoidosis, in addition to oftentimes getting a biopsy showing the granulomatous inflammation consistent with sarcoid, and probably even more importantly is excluding other causes both of their symptoms and of the granulomas on their biopsy, because there are a lot of other diseases that can, you know, mimic sarcoidosis. Sarcoids often known as the great mimicker. And so going through a process to be sure you're not missing another diagnosis like cancer or infection potentially causing the symptoms and the granulomatous inflammation is really important. You know, once a patient is diagnosed with the disease, a lot of what I do with people initially at their first visit is go through and try to assess what organs are affected. And I really triage that process by wanting to be sure we don't have any dangerous organ involvement first. And then we have more information about, you know, how urgently we need treatment or if we need treatment at all.
You mentioned treatment before. Can you speak more on what the treatment landscape looks like for that? You already mentioned that sometimes the treatment can actually perhaps make it worse for some of these patients. But yeah, what does the treatment look like and how do you manage that for these affected patients?
For most forms of sarcoidosis, prednisone or steroids is the first line treatment. Historically, it's worked well for the disease, but it's fraught with side effects. And so it's not a very good long-term treatment option. So if somebody's going to need to be on treatment for their sarcoidosis for an extended period of time, we often will talk to them about starting second and third line medications. And the goal of starting these second and third line medicines in the vast majority of patients is for those medicines to take over controlling the sarcoidosis and allow us to get them off of prednisone without their symptoms or their sarcoidosis getting worse. Sometimes, you know, if you just have a little bit of inflammation in your eyes, you know, your ophthalmologist may be able to prescribe some prednisone eye drops. And if that controls things, you may not need medications. The vast majority of people actually may not need any treatment. And so that, I mentioned Wells' law earlier, you know, sort of sticking to that rule, I think really helps prevent unnecessarily putting a lot of patients on treatment when they may not actually benefit from long-term treatment. You know, we've made some advances in the last decade or so in finding new treatment options, and there's even newer treatment options that we're currently studying, but that's one of the areas in sarcoidosis that we really, you know, need to work on moving forward is having better treatment options with fewer side effects, you know, they can really more definitively improve long-term outcomes and symptoms without negatively affecting people's quality of life.
Yeah, and I think that's actually a good segue to the next question about just the state of research for sarcoidosis, and you mentioned these newer treatments that are being looked at. Can you just speak more in detail of what that is and kind of where your gaze is sort of looking at for this domain of sarcoidosis?
Historically, sarcoidosis has been a very difficult disease to investigate, and part of that has to do with how variable the clinical presentations can be. That creates difficulty with research studies because when we're including patients in these studies, we need to be able to define a uniform population within sarcoidosis patients who we can then test a medicine or test an intervention on and be able to tell clearly, you know, what the outcome is. And because, you know, there's a difference between a sarcoidosis patient who only has lung involvement, for example, compared to one who has lung involvement, heart involvement, brain involvement, skin involvement. And so if you're looking at the effect of a treatment option on just their lung disease and they've got other organs involved, the other organs are going to affect the outcomes. And so interventional trials or treatment trials in sarcoid have been difficult. The other area that I think we, you know, really need to work on moving forward is trying to actually include more Black Americans or Black patients in these trials, because historically, you know, those are the patients most affected by the disease, but unfortunately they tend to be the ones that are least common in these trials. And so I think really as a, you know, as a group sort of moving forward and forming partnerships and trying to actually include the patients with the most severe disease in these trials is important. There's a lot of different directions to move in sarcoidosis. It's one of those things where there's so much we have to learn. You know, I hate to say, this is the one direction we need to go. You know, my personal bias is, you know, wanting to improve quality of life overall. And so, for example, we're doing a trial trying to come up with a smartphone app to improve sarcoidosis-associated fatigue and self-management of symptoms. And so, you know, sometimes investigating therapy options that don't include taking pills can ultimately make a big difference, and that's our hope. And ultimately, we'd love to be able to identify what that cause is and be able to cure sarcoidosis, obviously. Where we stand right now in terms of understanding the biology, though, just we're not quite to the point where we're really close to identifying an underlying cause, but hopefully in my lifetime we get there.
As my final question, which is two-pronged. So first prong, speaking to a clinician or anyone who's learning, wants to know more about sarcoidosis, what advice would you give them as the big things that they should know about it? And then secondly, for the patients, what sorts of avenues can they go to for support and education about their condition?
For physicians and practitioners, you know, I tell our fellows in training here all the time, you know, there's really only two things that you can do wrong when managing a sarcoid patient. One is to miss dangerous organ involvement, and then one is to treat a patient for no good reason. And so really taking the time, being confident in the diagnosis, being sure you're not missing other potential diseases that could explain symptoms, and then being sure that you have a clear treatment plan. You know exactly why you've decided to treat that patient. The patient is on board with it. They understand the rationale and how you're going to follow treatment response and what to do if treatment doesn't go well. For patients, I would say the more you know about sarcoidosis, the better. Unfortunately, if you get on the internet and just Google sarcoidosis, the results you get are not going to be very reliable. The Foundation for Sarcoid Research is a great resource for that. With their website is stopsarcoidosis.org. And they have not only good educational resources, but also opportunities to connect with other patients, because oftentimes when you get diagnosed with a rare disease, you kind of feel isolated, like there's nobody that you can talk to. And I think FSR does a good job of connecting patients with each other to be able to share experiences and say, hey, you know, I saw this physician, you know, what have you thought about him? Or I tried this medication, it really worked for me. Or has anybody had this symptom? And so trying to develop a community of support for sarcoid patients is really important.
Well, this was great, Dr. James. Thank you so much for this.
To keep up with all the latest rare disease news, check us out at hcplive.com and follow the Rare Disease Report on Twitter at RareDR, as well as on Facebook and LinkedIn. I'm your host, Jonathan Alisea, and stay tuned for the next Rare Disease Report.